I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. And now, a look at where we are with the legal case against the three armed white men who chased an unarmed black man, Ahmaud Arbery, a year ago, as he jogged through a neighborhood near the coastal Georgia town of Brunswick. This was a chase, you may recall, and some called it a manhunt, that led to Ahmaud's death when one of the men fired three rounds of buckshot into Ahmaud at close range. In the criminal case, each of the men has been charged on multiple counts of murder, and each has entered a plea of not guilty. They're now located in the county jail in Glenn County. They've been denied bond. Meanwhile, Ahmaud Arbery's name resonates across the world. His name is frequently mentioned under Georgia's gold Capitol dome, where legislators passed a hate crimes law and are now pressing, with the governor's support, to overhaul the citizen's arrest law. And his name is frequently seen on signs in different languages across the globe, including at major international tennis tournaments, where the world's top-ranked women's tennis player, Naomi Osaka, has worn a face mask bearing his name. I was recently invited to be part of the radio show Closer Look with Rose Scott, produced by WABE Atlanta. We discussed some of this, so have a listen.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this special edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, it marks 1 year since the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. This hour, in partnership with the Buried Truths podcast, I'll be joined by Hank Klibanoff, and we'll hear from guests as they recall, recap, and offer insight into a year later on the killing of Ahmaud Arbery.
This is not a wake for Ahmaud. This is a wake-up call for America. They must wake up and see what is happening to our people.
Glenn Brunswick Communications, Operator Smith.
I went to his room and I told him that I was leaving. I'll be back in the next couple of days. And I love you. And his last words to me was, I love you too.
There was right on.
And you said someone's breaking into it right now?
No, it's all open. It's under construction. And he's running right now. There he goes right now.
Okay, what is he doing?
He's running down the creek.
I need to ask you about that quote. Can you please articulate for the court what Mr. Bryan said he heard Travis McMichael say prior to police arriving and after the fatal shooting?
Yes, Mr. Bryan said that after the shooting took place, before police arrival, while Mr. Arbery was on the ground, that he heard Travis Michael make the statement.
Agents from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation effectuated an arrest on two individuals, Greg and Travis McMichaels, charging them with both felony murder and aggravated assault in regards to the killing of Ahmaud Arbery back in February of 2020 here in Glenn County.
And it's hard. My days are getting harder because Ahmad's never coming home.
He had a couple of nicknames, Maude and Quez. Ahmad Marquez Arbery, pretty good athlete, the youngest of three children. When he played football, he wore the number 21. Ahmad was quite the athlete, and he wore that football jersey number. That was also the number his older brother, Marcus Jr., wore. A year ago on this day, February 23rd, 2020, Ahmad Arbery did something he had been doing a lot, running. It was a sunny Sunday morning. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, recalled the last time she spoke with her son. As she prepared to go out of town, Ms. Cooper Jones popped into her son's room the Tuesday before he was killed.
It was early that morning. I went to his room, still lying in bed. And I went to his room and I told him that I was leaving. I'll be back in the next couple of days. And I love you. And his last words to me was, I love you too.
That clip from May 15th of last year as Ms. Cooper Jones was appearing on a segment with Dr. Phil. And joining me on today's broadcast from Emory University, award-winning veteran journalist, we'll call him Professor Hank Klibanoff, also director of the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project, and host of WAB's Peabody Award-honored Buried Truths podcast. The latest season is about the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. Hank, as always, I appreciate you taking the time. I really appreciate it. Good to see you.
Thank you, Rose. It's terrific to see you, too, and to be with you.
And for those that are concerned, we are distanced in our studio, so everybody's safe. Hank, it's been a year. In a year, 2020 like no other in our nation's scene, not only because of the pandemic, but Arbery's killing, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, here in Atlanta, Rayshard Brooks, each with different circumstances, Hank, but a familiar question and something you always tackle in the podcast, did they have to die? How do you reflect on this last year as it relates to this case?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is that for all but a few of us on this earth, this has been with us for 9 months, because the first 3 months, 74 days, whatever, you know, were, the story was not known. Mm-hmm. No one really knew about it. It was a very small item in the news, and that was it. But for the Ahmaud Arbery family, and for his close circle of friends, this has been a horrific year. And they are the ones who would be most likely to ask the question, did he have to die? Mm-hmm. And then as that circle of people grows who now know about it, everyone should be asking the question, did he have to die? And the answer is absolutely not. There is no reason for him not to be with us today. Mm-hmm. And people will speculate in different ways about, and people will have different opinions about why he died. They will ask, well, had he been white, would he have died? You know, these are all good questions.
Hank, for those that may not be familiar, and we hope that folks will become familiar if they're not, let's recap what Buried Truths, with this amazing storytelling podcast, is all about.
Well, Buried Truths began right here at WABE. Mm-hmm. I was teaching the course at Emory University, the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases class, and it's something that I had been doing before I came to Emory with journalists across the South in Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama, examining unpunished, racially motivated killings that took place. And you notice I call them killings, not murders, but they are murders, but they've never been adjudicated as
absolutely
murders. You know, so the journalist in me gets awfully prudish about that.
I feel the same way.
Right, right. So, and then when I came to Emory, that was part of my proposal for, the position I was seeking at Emory was that I would love to teach history in this hands-on investigative way. And to look at these unpunished racially motivated killings in Georgia history. And so up until, May of 2020, that's the kind of case I was examining, cases that fell between the end of World War II and 1968, 1970. So you saw Isaiah Nixon that we did a podcast on, A.C. Hall, right?
So why Ahmaud Arbery?
because he first it happened. I will tell you when I was down in Albany working on what was going to be season three, and then COVID broke out there in a very big way, and I could not stay there, and I certainly wasn't going to take my students there. And I was trying to figure out what would be next when the Arbery story breaks in May publicly. And it everything I learned, I said, wait, this just reminds me of everything we've been studying for in my classes since 2011. Mm-hmm. You know, this is history repeating itself and again and again.
So Hank, in telling the story of Isaiah Nixon, a father of six, killed in 1948, I think Montgomery County, Georgia, A.C. Hall, black teenager, who was, I'm using these air quotes, identified as a gun thief in 1962, gunned down in Macon, Georgia, Ahmaud Arbery. And although decades in between these killings, but several familiar optics, and one being at the core of this, whether folks agree with it or not, it's probably racism. As you started to, you and your students started to conceptualize the Ahmaud Arbery case here, where did you begin? Because you do more than just examine the current. Mm-hmm. You went way back to tell the story of this area.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, one of our watchwords of the Cold Cases Project and Buried Truth is we're not looking at who done it, we're looking at why. Mm-hmm. Because in most cases, we already know who done it. And we know that in the Ahmaud Arbery case. There's no dispute mm-hmm. who the three people are and what they did, okay? It's the why. And so we go at it from that wider angle that quickly narrows. And the more I learned about Glenn County, where this takes place, and the history of it, the more and the Glenn County Police Department, mm-hmm. which had just this terrible record of abusive behavior by its police officers, much of it indulged by law enforcement, and prosecutorial law enforcement, the district attorney's office, even though she did at one point before her term ended bring some indictments against some police officers, but not for some of the more egregious things that had happened there. And I just thought, you know, there's a rich, rich history. One of my students came in with a little detail looking at Glenn County it was one of the first seven counties in Georgia. Mm-hmm. It goes way, way back mm-hmm. to the origins of Georgia. And she, you know, 1777 is when that was formed.
Wow.
And early in the 1800s, as it depends totally on the enslavement of people who were brought here against their will, the population of Glenn County was 85% African American and 15% white. It had the greatest disparity of any county in the state, black over white. By 2020, when we did this podcast, it had shifted radically to 72% white. And you think, wow, that doesn't happen in very many counties, that it swings that widely, except for one thing, slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And it explains so much about the passage of time and yet the stillness of time.
Mm. I want to shift for a moment because I want to bring in to the conversation criminal defense attorney and WAB legal analyst Paige Pate, who also has an office down in that area. Paige, welcome to this special edition. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rose.
Glad to have you and Hank along here. Let's for a moment recap, I guess, the legal path leading up to now. On May 7th of last year, the GBI arrested Gregory McMichael, 64, Travis McMichael, his son, 34, for the death of Ahmaud Arbery. Now, Paige, they were both charged with murder and aggravated assault, correct?
That's right.
Now, Paige, I actually had a listener a while back who once said, bring him back because I have a question. And we talked about this, but each state is different. And so for our listeners, explain these charges. And the listener wanted to know, why not first degree or second degree murder?
Well, Rose, I think the simple answer is felony murder is much easier to prove. All the state has to do is show that the person who's charged with murder was committing some sort of violent felony act and somebody died. So in this case, the state has alleged that the McMichaels were assaulting Mr. Arbery by chasing him around with the car and ultimately pointing firearms at him. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, or during the course of that assault, he was shot and killed. Now, you can certainly charge someone with malice murder under this set of facts, but why take on that obligation of having to prove an intent to kill when you can get the same exact punishment, life in prison, with a felony murder charge? So I think that's why they decided to indict the case the way they did.
And then shortly thereafter, on May 21st, William Roddy Bryant, age 50, arrested, charged, felony murder and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. And these charges, explain that, Paige, for our listeners.
Well, again, the felony murder charge is based on Mr. Bryant's alleged felony, which is trying to falsely imprison Ahmad by chasing him around with his truck. You know, the whole scene was just a compilation of crime upon crime upon crime. Mm-hmm. I think it was somewhat difficult for the district attorney's office to try to streamline it into one solid case that's going to make sense to a jury. Because the worst thing you can do in a case like this, where everyone believes these people did something horribly wrong, the worst thing you can do is overcharge them and develop maybe some sort of compromise or sympathy on behalf of the jury, which does not belong in this case. So I think the DA's office has taken the right approach by charging them only with what they can clearly prove in court.
And I also want to give an update for our listeners, because all are still in jail. No bond has been granted. It's been a year now. Through your lens, not unusual, huh?
Not unusual in a murder case. I do believe, though, that given the background of the individuals who were charged, I don't think they had any criminal history, or certainly no significant criminal history. The fact that the charges were made at the time when there was an ongoing pandemic in the country, there have been zero jury trials in Glynn County for over a year. I'm right now, as we're talking, looking at the Glynn County Courthouse, and you know, there's not much going on there. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was possible, given the fact that there was no trial date in sight, that the judge may consider letting these folks out on bond. But obviously the judge decided not to do that, and they remain here in jail.
And Paige, we should note also that after some maneuvering and also some protesting, that the case was moved to another county, correct?
Not entirely. The case remains pending in Glynn County, although the judge is from Chatham County in Savannah. So for all of the proceedings relating to this case, he comes over to Glynn County. The DA, of course, is out of Cobb County because of a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. The local DA here couldn't handle the case or mishandled the case. It went to a second DA. It went to a third DA. And then eventually the attorney general moved it to the district attorney of Cobb County. But it is important that the case still remains in Glynn County. It's possible one or both sides could ask for a change of venue, move it to a different county for trial. But as of now, it's going to be tried in the courthouse right across the street from my office.
And as Hank pointed out, and I'll bring Hank into the conversation, you know, what they were able to reveal, Hank's students, you know, the history and the pattern of law enforcement in Glynn County. Hank, what did you all take that a little bit further for us? What did you, your students, reveal here?
Well, some of it had to do, we looked at some what appeared to be anomalies, and not even just about the case. I remember when we were having discussions here one day at WABE with our team of students and the WABE people. The question was, you know, are there any black prosecutors in the state of Georgia? And it turns out there are, but only in the most populous cities. You know, I think there were 7 out of the, is it 49 districts, judicial districts? I can't recall.
But probably a bulk of them in probably Fulton or DeKalb.
Fulton, Augusta, I think Columbus, but not very many, you know. And again, it just goes to when you're looking at a 70% ratio of whites to blacks down there, and in areas that many of us have always looked upon as being somewhat enlightened. I mean, I think they are. I think St. Simon's, you know, has a reputation for being relatively progressive. I think that Brunswick, same. It was, we were looking for, just to try to understand what is that area like today. And we went back and looked at the history of the families too, as you know. We looked at the McMichaels and went dug back into their history and Roddy Bryant's history. And you're looking for context. You're looking what motivated the McMichaels to immediately, when they see a kid running through the neighborhood, say, let's go get him. Let's go, you know, and grab their guns on the way. And, you know, it's not incriminating to say this, but, you know, we were interested to see that their families went all the way back to the Confederacy, you know, and that they fought for the Confederacy. That says two things. One, they fought for the Confederacy. Two, those families, the white families, go back a long, long way. Mm-hmm. Roddy Bryant's family founded the town of Baxley in Appling County, you know, which has one of the most dramatic Confederate memorials of any county in the state there.
Pace, let me ask you this, because based on what Hank just said, and you know, you've been in front of a lot of judges as a criminal defense attorney. When you can the prosecutors, do they need to go back as far as what Hank is talking about? Because to prove motive and to prove racial, that it was racially charged, or are you just trying to prove that we know that they were responsible for Ahmaud's killing? But if you're trying to connect racism and it was racially motivated, how difficult is that to do?
Well, Rose, I think it's important to point out that they don't need a racial motive to convict these people of murder. You know, all they need is an aggravated assault. Why they were committing the aggravated assault, it's not an element of the crime of murder. In other words, we all hear the expression, you don't need a motive to prove murder. And that's absolutely true, whether it's money, hate, racism, whatever it is. But I do think there is evidence of a racial motivation here. And I think that's going to come out in trial. But we don't have to go as far back as Hank and his folks have done. And by the way, I think they did a great job with that podcast. I've listened to every episode. Very well done, very detailed, and it spoke to the history of this place as well as to this case. But I think we can look at more recent activity, social media activity, which has already been a part of this case in court, and it's going to be admissible at trial. So when you have these individuals making racial slurs, obviously demeaning people of color all throughout their conversations, then it's not a difficult leap to say that that was somewhere in their minds as they were pursuing Ahmaud through this neighborhood.
The voice you hear is WABE legal analyst and criminal defense attorney Paige Pate. I'm also joined by Emory University professor Hank Klibanoff and also host of WABE's award-winning podcast, Buried Truths. When we come back, we'll continue this special edition of Closer Look. We'll talk a little bit more about the legal proceedings, and also we'll dig a little bit further into what Buried Truths has been able to reveal.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org. Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
And this special edition of Closer Look continues here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. I'm joined today on this broadcast from Emory University, veteran journalist and professor Hank Klibanoff, also director of the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project, of course, host of WABE's Peabody Award-winning Buried Truths podcast. Also joined by WABE legal analyst and criminal defense attorney who is down in the Brunswick area, Paige Pate. And Paige, real quickly, and Hank, some breaking news regarding this. This coming from Kelly Wiley on Twitter. Ahmaud Arbery's mother has filed a federal lawsuit against the Glynn County Police Department and the first two state prosecutors on the case, Jackie Johnson and George Barnhill. Paige, I'll start with you. Your reaction to that?
Well, this is the first I've heard of it. I have not read the lawsuit, but I would assume, given the one-year anniversary, this is certainly the time to pursue the case if she's going to, against not the individuals who committed the crime, but people who, at least some think, were involved in an attempted cover-up of the crime. Because, you know, watching some of the body cam videos that we've seen recently that have been released, and I think Hank mentioned this or referred to it, this case really came very close to never making it to court. I don't think people realize how close the McMichaels came to completely getting away with what happened that day. And it was only through the release of the video, the public attention, the quick action, frankly, of the GBI and the Attorney General's office to move this case towards prosecution. So I think perhaps this lawsuit is an attempt to hold the local police department, the DA at the time. She's since been defeated. She's no longer district attorney down here. But the DA at the time and a DA in an adjoining circuit responsible for what some believe was an attempted cover-up.
Hank, your reaction to hearing this?
No, I think that's exactly right. The question, I guess, in my mind is whether a lawsuit increases the pressure on the U.S. Department of Justice to move forward on its purported investigation into possible prosecutorial misconduct. Same with the state attorney general. Both were pretty expressed dismay at the way that, you know, this became three-card Monty with the prosecutors there, where Jackie Johnson of Glynn County has to recuse herself because Greg McMichael had worked for her, and then she turns it over directly to George Barnhill of Waycross rather than go first to the Attorney General and get him to, you know, name the person to replace her when she recused herself. I think she said at one point she tried to call the Attorney General and couldn't find his phone number. So whatever it was, George Barnhill gets the case the same day that Ahmaud Arbery is killed, and by noon the next morning has declared that he was guilty of burglary and that these men had the right to get involved in killing him and arresting him or trying to, and that the killing was justified.
Paige, when we talk about then the accountability as it relates to law enforcement, not the officers, I'm talking about prosecutors here, what needs to be proved in order for accountability to be served, whatever that looks like?
Yeah, that's a complicated question given the facts of this case. I don't know what the Department of Justice's criminal investigation may have uncovered to this point. We know that they've interviewed everyone involved in the case. Hank had mentioned that investigation is ongoing, and it is, as far as we know. But as is typical with the Department of Justice, they're not telling us what's happening. You know, they don't tell us any preliminary findings or this is what we have so far. We don't know what they've uncovered in that case. But to prosecute someone for federal civil rights violations, the government would have to show that there was an animus here, an attempt to try to deprive these individuals of their civil rights. It's different from a state criminal case because they have to prove that additional component of a deprivation of civil rights. There could also be charges relating to a violation of their oath of office to faithfully prosecute individuals and also faithfully administer justice in their circuits. That would be more of a state offense, and it's certainly possible that could happen as well.
And Paige, in the order then, would this federal lawsuit, would that have to occur before then the criminal trial actually begins? How does that work?
No, and that's an interesting point. You know, it may tell us something about the federal criminal investigation, because if there is an active federal criminal investigation, I would anticipate that the prosecutors in the Southern District of Georgia will try to pause this lawsuit. They will not want civil discovery to be going on concurrent with a criminal investigation. So we may find out if there's an active criminal investigation by watching what the U.S. Attorney's Office does in response to the filing of this lawsuit. Do they try to stay it, pause it, or do they simply ignore it?
Paige, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the term, when you talk about civil discovery?
Sure. That's depositions, answering questions. Whenever somebody sues somebody else, both sides have the opportunity to discover information about the case. And they do that through sworn testimony in a deposition or exchanging documents or written answers to questions.
Hank, let's talk about the community, because you all talk to so many different people. What did you and your students discover about Ahmad and the community that he was from? I want to focus on him for a moment now.
Well, certainly within his family, he was beloved. People had only the fondest memories of him as a sweet fellow. You know, always said, "I love you," when he was leaving not just his aunt's place, but anybody in the family. You know, he had been a football player and was among those who was not recruited to go off to play in college and didn't make it to the pros, as quite a few of his fellow Brunswick High teammates did. And it was remarkable to me how many people turned out to support him and to keep his memory alive. Now, he had some rough scrapes. We know that. We played. However, I have to say, when anything that he got in trouble for, I'm skeptical of, to be honest with you. After we saw the video of police stopping him in a park, and just, I don't know, we let it run a lot in the podcast. It went on and on and on, and the police had nothing. They had nothing to go on. There was no warrant out for him, and they just weren't going to let him go. And the cop keeps saying, "I think I see seeds, you know, in his car, and Ahmad won't let me get in the car, so I really can't." I mean, who cares? And I just felt like we were reliving Ferguson, you know, and broken taillights and things like that. But his family stood by him and believed in him, and their hearts are still very, very broken, and they're very, very angry.
There is a photo of Ahmad's grandmother as she sits near his gravesite. If you haven't seen that, it is very, very, very telling. Paige, when we talk about, and here's a question from a listener, it just makes sense. Ask Paige when the trial is going to start. I mean, we are still in a pandemic, but that's actually a good question. You know, what's going on here?
Well, my understanding is the Supreme Court has said trials can begin as soon as next month in March. The new district attorney in Glynn County is already figuring out how he's going to impanel jurors to hear trials. It's going to be very different than in the past. It doesn't look like the McMichaels lawyers have requested a speedy trial. They have not demanded one. I think right now they're comfortable to let the clock tick. Maybe they're learning more about the case, doing their own investigation. But I would anticipate we'll probably see the case go to trial late summer, early fall, barring some intervention by the judge.
And Paige, you're down there. You know, you're in the heart of all this. What's the, I guess, the word among the legal community? What are the questions, or just what's that the topic that everyone is talking about in terms of we need to watch this and see what happens? Take our listeners to that.
Well, surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, I guess it depends on where you are in the state, but people down here, at least the people that I, you know, have encountered and what we've seen publicly reported in the local news, are uniformly convinced that Ahmaud Arbery was murdered. There doesn't seem to be, and I think this is indicative, not necessarily indicative, but illustrated by the grand jury who met down here and indicted these folks with these very serious charges in very short order. It did not take them long to consider the case. And these are people from the local community, from the McMichaels community, from Bryant's community, who know these folks. And they didn't have a problem at all seeing this as an egregious criminal act.
Hank, what do you make of when all of this does get underway and the trial and just this, where this case, you know, you've examined and done analysis on so many of these cases, but here in the 21st century, you know.
You know, there's a part of me that feels like it's going to be more than Greg and Travis McMichael and Roddy Bryant on trial. I don't want to overstate this, but to some extent, it's Georgia is on trial. Georgia history has favored the white people when it comes to these cases. Mm-hmm. Certainly if they were in law enforcement, now Greg McMichael had been in law enforcement, and he certainly was treated by law enforcement and by the prosecutor in this case as if he were still in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. But overall, I would say that Georgia, you know, will be on trial, and the world has been watching Georgia pretty close in the last several months because of our two Senate race runoffs. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people thought there was some, redemption in that. I think that this is going to be another opportunity for Georgia to try to redirect its history and its historical racism.
Yeah, Hank and Paige, earlier I had a conversation with the Atlanta attorney and social justice activist and vice president of the NAACP chapter of Atlanta, Gerald Griggs, and our conversation centered around what has become a familiar action of demanding accountability and justice. And as we go to break, I just want to play a clip of that interview with Gerald, if we have it ready. Gerald, is there anything different about this movement as it relates to Ahmaud and George and Breonna?
I think there's definitely a difference. We have more awareness. More people are taking notice of the plight of African Americans than ever before. You know, I talk to my mentors in the civil rights movement, and they say this movement is a lot bigger than that one. And I respectfully tell them, I hear what you're saying, but we haven't accomplished what we need to accomplish yet. So I think the moment is right. From Ahmaud, which started the new revival of the social justice movement. Then it moved to Louisville, Kentucky with Breonna Taylor. And then, of course, 8 minutes and 46 seconds we saw in Minnesota with George Floyd. And then it shifted to Atlanta with Rayshard Brooks and Vincent Truitt. And now we're here. And my hope is that lawmakers will have the gumption and the courage to pass legislation as they're trying to do here in Georgia. With the repeal of citizens' arrest, and as with the George Floyd police reform bill that's in Congress and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, I'm hopeful that we can hit the same milestones that the civil rights movement hit. I'm hopeful there's more attention.
Well, Gerald, let's stick with that for a moment, because when you talk about the movement, and often I ask the question about how effective is the movement to get actionable outcomes, do you make some inroads in terms of police reform? If you get a measure like the citizen's arrest that's amended, because it hasn't totally been repealed, but here in Georgia, it's going to be changed. Is that how you measure then the effectiveness of the movement?
No, it's not how you measure the effectiveness of the movement. The movement is the people coalescing. Mm-hmm. And we've seen millions of people march in solidarity. We've seen leagues come in solidarity. We've seen business organizations come in solidarity. That's how you measure the movement. But the ultimate goal is justice. And until we see Travis and Gregory McMichael and William Roddy Bryant sent to prison, until we see Derek Chauvin sent to prison, until we see the officers that killed Breonna Taylor sent to prison, and of course the officers that killed Garrett Rolfe and Devin Brosnan here in Atlanta, killed Rayshard Brooks, and the officer that killed Vincent Truitt sent to prison, the movement will continue. We have to remember the civil rights movement lasted for between 12 to 14 years. We're really in year 7 of this movement. So I just think that we are continuing to make inroads, continuing to apply pressure. My hat's off to the young people that have been the lifeblood of this movement. Many of them have been named and some of them have been unnamed. But I am resolute in believing that we will achieve the ends of justice and you will see a new America. We saw it with unprecedented voter turnout because of what happened to Ahmaud and what happened to George and what happened to Breonna and what happened to Rayshard. Now it's time for our elected officials to do what we sent them to Washington and to Atlanta to do, and that's change laws.
Well, let's start then in Washington. You are encouraged with the Biden administration and their initiatives or their promises, because, initiative is one thing and a promise is another. You encourage with the Biden administration in terms of addressing some of these issues?
No, absolutely not. I appreciate the executive order, but it didn't go far enough. They need to implement the Obama 21st Century Policing Initiative, which is a solution and they need to do it now. So, you know, they're taking steps. I do appreciate the representation on his cabinet level of many positions, but we need actual action. So we in the activist community have been dedicated to giving him 100 days of grace period. But that 100 days will be up May the 1st, and we will be back to what we've been doing for the last 6 years. And that's agitating and activating and advocating on the behalf of these individuals whose lives have been affected by racism, systemic racism, as well as police brutality. And we are calling on him to make affirmative steps with legislation. The George Floyd Police Reform Bill is there. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act is there. The Obama 21st Century Policing Initiative is the solution to police brutality. He needs to pass these initiatives immediately, either by executive order or by legislation. And he needs to do it in the first 100 days.
Are you encouraged with Merrick Garland as the nominee for the United States Attorney General?
I am. I think that he brings an intelligence and a legal background that could help move us forward in civil rights. So I am encouraged by his appointment. I'm also encouraged by Kristen Clark, who's up for nominee for parts of the Justice Department. And I forget the other young lady's name, but those selections are very strong and I'm hopeful, but we still need something done in the first 100 days.
Gerald, as we wrap up, and you know, I went back and I looked at all of the rallies and the protests and the marches and the individuals, just your thoughts on the community coming together.
Well, I think that we're going to have to do this the rest of our lives. You know, this country was born out of a protest, and the protest is what got us the charges for William Rowdy Bryant and the McMichaels. And we have to continue to rally. They have hearings coming up. We have to be at every hearing. They will have a trial coming up. We have to be at the trial. We have to make sure the judge and the jury understand that we loved our dear brother Ahmaud and that we stand with Wanda Cooper Jones, and we will continue to advocate on behalf of Ahmaud till we get justice. So we will continue to do this until justice is fair, balanced, and equitable.
Gerald Griggs is an Atlanta-based attorney, social justice activist, and vice president of the Atlanta NAACP chapter. Attorney Griggs, as always, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rose.
And Closer Look continues now here. A very special Closer Look here on 90.1 WABE. And last choice for NPR, I'm Rose Scott, joined by Hank Klibanoff and Paige Pate. And Paige, I had a listener actually just send this in and wanted to know your thoughts on this. The lawyers of the three charged have specifically asked for Ahmaud not to be referred to as a victim. Through your lens, what's that about?
Well, you know, a defense lawyer doesn't want there to be an acknowledgement by the court, by the other lawyers, by people who are testifying that there's been a crime until someone's been convicted of a crime. So this is not an uncommon thing. We see lawyers ask for this in murder cases, rape cases, serious sexual assault cases, because once the terminology of victim starts getting used in court, before the verdict's even reached, there's a tendency for people to already assume that somebody's guilty of committing a crime. So it's not uncommon. You know, it's a strategy that defense lawyers routinely use in cases like this.
And Hank, this is not lost on you and all the research and all the cases that you have covered, researched, and analyzed. That's not lost on you that the defense might go this round.
No, the defense has, you know, a big bag of tricks that it wants and strategies. I don't want to diminish it. I will say this, it's interesting, I can see that journalists who are going to be covering it will refer to Ahmaud Arbery as a victim. There's no simpler way to describe, you know, this. And he is. I mean, I think you just watch any of the video or hear any of these stories and there's no question but that he was being pursued. He was the subject / victim of a manhunt.
Mm-hmm. You know, Hank, in the montage coming into today's program, and we played clips from a hearing with the GBI officer, and we bleeped out the the F and the N word. I think we all know what both what those are. I want to get your thoughts on that. And Paige, you can weigh in on this too, in terms of as a defense attorney, using that word. When you're in a court of law, you use the word. People say, well, that could be incriminating, because if a white person uses that word, it means they're definitely racist, and that's all you have to prove. But as Paige has alluded to already, it's not about necessarily proving it was racially motivated. You prove that they killed, this is what they want to prove, that Ahmaud was murdered by these two men. But here we are again, it goes back to race. Whether people want to admit it or not, it goes back to race with this case.
And it's all going to be, and Paige would know this better than I, it's all going to be part of the strategic plan, you know, on both sides. I mean, there was one of our civil rights code cases going back to 1964 of white men who were accused of killing Lemuel Penn, a lieutenant colonel who was driving from Fort Benning back to Washington, D.C., where he was a school administrator. And, you know, there was great offense taken by white jurors that two black men who were in the car with him showed up in court when the trial finally came around wearing their Army Reserve uniforms. Mm-hmm. And that was considered, you know, a bad strategic move because it kind of thumbed their nose at white people, you know, to show that these were accomplished African Americans. Mm-hmm. So it's all part of the strategy, and I'm sure the prosecution will have as many designs as the defense.
Paige, let's talk about jury selection here. You know, obviously, I don't know if you can go anywhere in the region and find someone who has not heard about this case, but what would, I guess, disqualify someone from being, you know, a potential juror in this case?
Well, the magic word is I've reached an opinion about the case. So having heard about the case in the news, having seen reports in the media, that's not enough to disqualify someone from serving on a jury. Or you're right, it'd be virtually impossible to pick a jury anywhere, not just in Glenn County, but anywhere. Mm-hmm. So the judge is going to be, in both sides, the lawyers will be very, I won't say aggressive, but very focused on asking questions about what have you heard? What do you think about that? Have you discussed the case with friends of yours, people at work, in the church? To try to see what opinions people have already reached. And frankly, this is one of those cases, and I think Hank said it well, you see the video, you reach a conclusion. Mm-hmm. Didn't take the GBI long to do that either. So it's going to be very difficult to find people who truly have no opinion. Now, you may find folks that say they have no opinion because maybe they want to be on this jury for a couple of different reasons. But finding a truly impartial jury is going to be a challenge here or in any county where the case may be tried.
WABE legal analyst and criminal defense attorney Paige Pate, as we conclude this special edition of Closer Look. Hank Klibanoff, as always, thank you so much. Professor over at Emory University, director of the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Case Project.
Thank you, Rich.
You got a Peabody on your desk.
Thank you. Thanks.
Also the author of one of the greatest books I think that every journalist should read in the race beat. Gentlemen, if you want to have some final words about your takeaway a year later, you can share them now if you want to. Paige, I'll start with you.
Well, I think everyone here is ready for some closure to this part of this struggle. Get this case over with. These folks are likely to be convicted, but the question is what's next? And I don't mean just laws. I mean culturally. I mean systemically. We've got a long way to go, not just in Georgia, but in many places.
And Hank, I'll give you the last word on
all
that.
Right, just to encourage the general public to always approach these with some skepticism, not cynicism, but skepticism. In my back of my head, I keep hearing that 911 operator asking the question, can you tell me what he is doing wrong? And no one was ever able to say what Ahmaud Arbery was doing wrong. And therefore, he died. Not having done something wrong.
You've been listening to what I consider a very special edition of Buried Truths, and I'd like to thank the staff of WABE's Closer Look and host Rose Scott for the invitation to be on their program and for the insight that we were able to share today. If you want to hear more episodes of Closer Look with Rose Scott, which I highly recommend, subscribe to her podcast on your favorite podcast player or stream Rose online every weekday at 1 p.m. Eastern at WABE.com. www.buried-truths.org. Buried Truths is a production of WABE Atlanta. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.